We are glad to make all of our JCast Network podcasts free for our listeners. However, they are not free to produce and host. Please consider making a donation to JCast Network to help support our work by visiting jcastnetwork.org/donate. Thanks for your support.
The Jewish Hour can now be heard on jcastnetwork.org, your portal to Jewish broadcasting. It's also on iTunes and on your smartphone using the Stitcher app. Welcome to the Jewish Hour. I'm your host, Herschel Finman. We have got a great show for you today. In this half hour of the show, we'll be talking about Yiddish, the, millennia-old phenomena of what Jews have been speaking in Western and Central and Eastern Europe, too, as a matter of fact. European Jewry has been speaking. And we'll be doing that with Yiddish scholar, Detroit's own Nachum Eichenhorn. We have a wonderful assortment of Jewish music peppered throughout the show. The portion of the week is the portion of Chaya Sora, which can be found in Genesis chapter 22. And following, we have a very thought-provoking, inspirational Hasidic story at the end. Before we do anything else, let's go right to the news. Following the destruction of Hamas-built tunnel from Gaza to Israel that killed 8 Palestinians, Israel is refusing to allow Hamas to recover the bodies from the destroyed tunnel until Hamas returns the bodies of 4 slain soldiers held in Gaza since 2014 and the 2 Ethiopians believed to still be alive who wandered into Gaza. That's fair enough. Couldn't exchange bodies for bodies. An Israeli man from the North Druze town of Majd al-Shams was near the Syrian border was wounded by stray gunfire from Syria. The man was lightly wounded and was treated at the scene. In response, Israeli planes destroyed a munitions factory in southern Syria. The driver of a Palestinian vehicle in the West Bank was shot and killed after accelerating his car towards soldiers and not heeding their warnings to stop. The terrorist was shot twice and died of his injuries. His sister was shot and wounded. A bomb threat forced the cancellation of an event at the Jewish Museum of Florida celebrating the 100th anniversary of the Balfour Declaration. Law enforcement people arrested a 21-year-old college student who attends Florida International University. Dogs found traces of explosives in the student's car. We reported about this a while ago, but the menorah in front of the Chabad House of the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign was vandalized for the fourth time in 2 years. Security cameras caught 2 people pushing over the 9-foot menorah, then breaking off a branch and walking off with it. The broken branch was returned Sunday morning. The Chabad House is making a steel menorah, hopefully student-proof, that hopefully we'll be up by Hanukkah, which is in December. And speaking of which, you can mark on your calendar that Jewish Ferndale will be having its menorah lighting, its grand menorah lighting, on the Monday night of Hanukkah, which is December the 18th, 6 p.m. Check the website, www.jewishferndale, for details. And in follow-up to a story from last week, Israel won 5 medals, including 1 gold, in the international judo competition held in the United Arab Emirates. Despite being told by the World Judo Federation to treat the Israeli athletes equally to other participants, Israelis were not allowed to wear their flag on the uniforms, and Hatikva was not played at the awards ceremony. And that's the news.
Some of the best jobs in the world are in the radio and television industry, and you too can join the workforce in as little as 8 months when you complete your hands-on training at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts located in Southfield, Michigan. At Specs Howard School, students get to play and learn at the same time. Imagine spending your class time behind the microphone, spinning music and hosting your own radio show, or designing and lighting a set for your own TV program, running a camera, learning to edit, directing a program. When you go to Specs, your day will be anything but dull. And if school is this fun, imagine how exciting it is to work in the growing industry. In addition, the credits you earn while attending Specs Howard School are currently accepted at 14 area colleges and universities. If you've always wanted the best job in the world, call for a tour of Specs Howard School at 248-358-9000. That's 248-358-9000, or visit them on the web at specshoward.edu. Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. This is where you start.
Herschel Finman, here you are listening to the Jewish Hour. We have online noted Yiddish scholar Nachum Eichenhorn, who is now making his home in Detroit, as he did when he was a kid, back again to the homeland. How are you, Nachum?
I'm doing well, Rabbi. How are you?
Good, thank God, Baruch Hashem, as we say. Okay, let's talk some history before we get into anything else. The development of a language is like really a very fascinating thing. And here it is. You have Jews, you know, we have the expression the wandering Jew. There's a plant called the wandering Jew, which sends out its little things and all over the place. So Jews were living in something called Judea 2,000 years ago. And then the Romans came and they moved them around into like the Mediterranean area. You have Italy and Spain and et cetera. And they wind up in North and Morocco. And then you always had the Jews from the first diaspora still living in the eastern countries of Iraq and Persia, India, etc. So then there's this like displacement, and Jews wind up in Europe. And what's with this Yiddish stuff? Why didn't they just like Jews who moved to Poland start speaking Polish like Jews in America do?
Well, that's an interesting question, and the answer is complicated.
We have time.
Scholars are actually kind of disagreed on this. The truth is that nowhere did Jews end up in mass speaking the language of the places where they lived, even in the first diaspora. It's more understandable because it was much shorter in the first diaspora. But the second one, wherever they ended up, they spoke some sort of pidgin or patois of Hebrew, Aramaic, and the languages they encountered. This was also true when they settled along the Rhine River in Germany. Now, an interesting thing happened there in that they went to one place and then had to go backtrack and go to a different place. By all accounts, or assumptions, really, scholars believe that they were speaking a kind of Judeo-German very, very early on, more than 1,000 years ago, when they first arrived in these kind of Germanic lands. And then once they went to Eastern Europe, they didn't stop speaking this kind of Hebrew, Aramaic, Middle German patois. And when they resettled in Eastern Europe, in isolation, it kind of became its own language, and stopped being mutually intelligible.
Okay, this is pretty fascinating because, as you say, you have around the Mediterranean, for example, you have the Jews in Italy speak a Judeo-Italian, the Jews in France and in Spain speak Ladino, which is a Judeo-Spanish. The Jews along the top of North Africa speak a Judeo-Arabic. So wherever they seem to move, they seem to like forget about what was going next. Here it is. They moved to Germany. So you would think if they're moving to Poland, so they're going to stop speaking Judeo-German and you're now start speaking Judeo-Polish. But Yiddish carried away all the way through into from Poland into the Balkans, into Russia. This is the language that Jews seem to adhere to in Europe. Any guesses to why this phenomenon attracted, why the Germans stuck with it?
Well, I'll say that any answer I could give you would be
purely speculative because you weren't there, yes.
Yeah.
But
the relative autonomy that Jews had in Eastern Europe, for better or for worse, I mean, they had the autonomy, but it was because nobody wanted to deal with them. Kind of ensured that they would be able to preserve their own language. There was a kind of positive autonomy early on in Poland, where Jews were allowed to kind of conduct their own affairs because they were welcome. Of course, in the Russian Empire, they were allowed to conduct their own affairs because they couldn't go to the police. But the kind of development of shtetlach and Jewish settlements and Jewish towns where either a majority or a significant minority of the population would be Jewish, along with the kind of linguistic mix that was happening in what was variously conquered by various duchies and empires, kind of allowed Yiddish to thrive and remain. Interestingly, you see a very similar thing happen in the modern era when you note the difference between Jews that came to the United States and Jews that ended up in Quebec. Jews that came to the United States were under enormous pressure to become like everyone else and largely lost their native languages relatively quickly, whereas in Montreal, the kind of situation that was there already, in that people spoke different languages, there were people who spoke French, there were people who spoke English, and that was kind of the status quo, meant that Jews were under less pressure to assimilate for several reasons. One, because they didn't believe assimilation was possible. There was not much more anti-Semitism, but just there wasn't even a chance that they were going to end up being Canadians like other Canadians at the time. So Yiddish actually survived much longer, and these kind of Yiddish institutions survived longer in places like Montreal than they did in places like Cleveland.
Okay. It's interesting you brought this up because this actually was my next question. When I was younger, I spent 4 years in Australia, and the bulk of the Australian Jewish community were Holocaust survivors. So their children were people who were like my age who spoke Yiddish because they would basically be the same generation as my mother's generation whose parents were immigrants and came to America. But their kids also spoke Yiddish. They felt it necessary their children were like my mother and Bubby, they spoke Yiddish so that I shouldn't understand, which I picked it up anyway, I could understand them anyway. But the people in Australia, so they're teaching their kids Yiddish. They want their kids to be able to carry that on. And was it the melting pot theory that was the tone for that? Because I was thinking, what's so different about Australia? What's so different about Australia? But really the question is, what's so different about America then? Because we had this melting pot theory and just get in and become an American as soon as you possibly could.
Right. The melting pot, I've heard it described by some scholars as insidious tolerance.
Okay.
Or insidious acceptance. The melting pot is kind of an out. It's no longer the politically appropriate thing to believe. It's multiculturalism is now the thing that's kind of in vogue. The melting pot essentially means to erase individuality, to erase, to a certain extent, one's culture in any way that would be inconvenient for the majority. So you could keep eating sushi, but stop being Shinto, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, understood. I mean, there's a linguist joke that goes something like, if a person speaks four languages, he's a polyglot, and if he speaks two languages, he's bilingual, and if he speaks language, what do you call him? American. Okay, maybe is that the reason why, or what would you attribute there has been over the last, we've been on the air for 20 years, and I would say over the last 15, 18 years, there has been this resurgence in Yiddish. I mean, you were very involved with the Yiddish Book Center in Massachusetts, and you have publishing new dictionaries, and universities are now teaching Yiddish classes as part of a curriculum. So are Jews collectively now waning nostalgic for this, the language of their bubbies?
Well, as much as I would like to say that that's no part of it, of course, I think that is some part of it. There is an enormous nostalgic impulse, I think, amongst American Jews. But I think there is something else to it as well. I think Jews, especially in the United States, I think the generation before mine, and maybe even the generation before yours, Rabbi, was almost defined by a central shame in their Jewishness. That, I mean, if you look at documents from certain Jewish movements, if you look at kind of how Jews are written about and how Jews, you know, there's a specific article from the Atlantic Monthly from the 1930s by a woman who justifies her decision to fall in love with a Jewish man, which is one of my favorite artifacts of this kind of insidious shame. You know, he's a good man, even though he's a Jew, and his strange face, and he doesn't wear those silly hats like those other ones. He's more like us than he is like them, you see. So it's okay that I married him. And this was just normal. This was the idea. And I think now people, especially Jews, are feeling more able to kind of live without that shame. And it's an interesting thing that is almost, it's certainly not unique to Jews, but I think it's particular to a group of people who were never considered, for lack of a better term, white, but were kind of suddenly able to pass as white. James Baldwin, the famous African American author and scholar, actually wrote about this. It was an essay, I think it was called Why Blacks Don't Like Jews. And it was essentially blaming Jews for having abandoned their minority because they could. And this is kind of the you know, I mean, certainly talked about even in the Torah that a big part of why we remain small and why we remain diasporic is to be able to have this experience, and by abandoning that experience, it's a unique opportunity to do that in the United States. It's very tempting. But I think nowadays that impulse is kind of reversing itself. People end up with nothing. There's, you know, hollowed out. There's nothing in the middle. They have this shell, but the center of their identity has been sort of forgotten. So when they look for it, they end up finding it. And it's much more comfortable to, it turns out, to not be constantly dogged by a discomfort one can't identify because of a terrible shame one's grandparents carried around and thereby obliterated their identities, and now you have to re-find it.
That's a fascinating idea. If you're just joining us, our guest today is Nachum Eichenhorn, who's a Yiddish scholar. And by the way, we'll be beginning a Yiddish class, a Yiddish conversation class, at Jewish Ferndale. Check the website for when it'll begin. It'll be Tuesdays at 7:30, and we're not exactly sure when it will start, but sometime this month, hopefully. This last week, we celebrated 100 years of the Balfour Declaration granting Israel the right to exist, the state of Israel the right to exist. And the founding fathers of the Zionist movement, we're talking like Ben Yehuda and Theodor Herzl and et cetera, were very much opposed. They were European Jews, but they were very much opposed to the language of the street in Israel being Israel, and really pushed Hebrew. Would you say that that was a major setback for the promulgation of Yiddish then, Nachum?
I think it was one of the most major setbacks. In the very beginning of the Zionist movement, there was kind of this battle between the Yiddishists and the Hebraists. Pretty quickly, it became clear the Hebraists were going to be kind of the mainstream. At the beginning of the state, Yiddish was just practically speaking, very oppressed. People would, you know, the Palmach would smash Yiddish printing presses, and people would, you know, you would get tax breaks for printing in Hebrew, but you would get fined for printing in Yiddish. There were signs all over with, you know, these big, strong, fatigue-clad Jews that said, Hebrew, speak Hebrew. And I think there was this, I think it's rather subtle and complex why Hebrew was chosen.
Was Yiddish looked as being, let me just interrupt, was Yiddish looked as, say, like the language of the oppressed people and Hebrew was the language of the liberated people?
I think that's a simple way of putting it. I think, yeah, that's the essential conflict. But it's even more than that. Yiddish was the language of Jewy Jews. If you look at early Hebrew poetry, when it talks about kind of what was going on in Europe versus what was going on in then British Mandate Palestine, it was, oddly enough, an assimilationist exercise. The early Zionists wanted nothing more than to be a nation among nations. They didn't want to be special or different or strange. They wanted to kind of assimilate the, you know, Daniel Boyarin talks about this in his wonderful book. I'm forgetting the title of his book, but it's about the perception of manliness in Jewish culture for the past several thousand years.
So if the Israelis could have Hebrew as a language and not rely on Yiddish, which that was sort of like this European amalgam, that would indicate that Israel was a real country and not just some fall away from something
and
that
not,
fell out
and,
of Europe.
And not just that. It was a real country and that these men were men and not just Jews.
That's fascinating.
They weren't weak and backward and Yiddish speaking and Talmud learning. They were men with strong arms and guns and shovels and farming. And it was, you know, there's this concept of the new Jew. Hebrew was the language of the new Jew as well as the old Jew, which is why you see early Zionists would name their children names that were not very traditional because they were the names of biblical villains. But they would be named them because those biblical characters were great warriors. And that was more important than being named, say, David or Solomon. They would name their kids Nimrod or, you know, these names of great non-Jewish warriors in the Bible.
Mm-hmm. I didn't come across any Goliaths in my travels, but yeah, I can understand
what
you're saying.
No, there's no.
I can understand that. Okay,
well, you can never know. You can't name a kid Goliath if he turns out 5'2". It's going to be, you know,
it'll be really
we'll never
bad.
Hear the end of it.
Yeah, that'll be really bad for the kid too. So okay, so now you're not only just a scholar, a student of Yiddish, but you're also a teacher of Yiddish. So a person wants to learn a new language. So they have these things. They're called, some languages are called hard languages to learn, and some other languages are called easy languages to learn. But I suppose when it comes to learning, once you learned it already, it's now easy. So where would you classify like the idea of if a person wants to take a class and to be able to actually say, well, I can speak Yiddish somewhat now. I can make myself understood.
Well, linguistically, it all depends on the language you come from. But since all of my students so far have come from English, it's very easy, actually. I think it's one of the easiest languages to learn for an English speaker. You know, they say one of the easiest languages to learn is Spanish, but I would think Yiddish is even easier than Spanish.
I happen to have learned both of those, and I happen to agree with you. Yiddish is much easier than Spanish.
Yeah, the kind of underlying grammatical structure is because both English and Yiddish come from a kind of middle high German grammatical structure. It's very similar. It's kind of intuitive. You figure it out very, very quickly. And once you have that underlying structure very, very quickly, it becomes a matter of vocabulary. Although there is this, there are slight differences. And of course the handy trick that a student taught me is that, if you imagine, you know, you'll begin to say sentences in your native language's grammar that end up sounding a little strange in the target language. So one of my students says, oh, here's how I fix that. I imagine it coming out of the mouth of an old Jewish man, and however he would say it is the right Yiddish grammar.
So what the person was doing, instead of translating English to Yiddish, they're translating Yinglish to...
Right.
Got it, understood. When I was in high school, so I was debated with the idea of speaking German, and I spoke to the German teacher, and I said, well, I speak Yiddish. And they said, I don't think you want to speak. I don't think you want to take German, because it's just going to confuse the heck out of you. Because he told me, he says, there's a guy who came to hear a German lecture, and after an hour and a half, he apologized that he had to leave before the verb. So you don't have that kind of like German structure and grammar in Yiddish, that sideways way of talking from English. It is more English-based.
Yeah, it's definitely more natural feeling. And there's options, in a way. The kind of like English and Yiddish, you can construct a sentence in one of several ways. In German, there's one correct way, and you'll sound strange if you kind of deviate from it. You can figure out like how people would speak in Yiddish, but it's kind of like the harmonica. It's easy to learn and hard to master.
Mm-hmm. That's true. When I was first learning Yiddish back in yeshiva, it took me, I would say, about 2 years of like some serious effort. And I would say I was communicating in Yiddish properly with all the native born Yiddish speakers. So I went to a rabbi and I said to him, can you give me some rules of grammar in speaking Yiddish? And he said, there is one rule of grammar. If it sounds like Yiddish, it's Yiddish. And if it doesn't sound like Yiddish, it's not Yiddish. So, which case I just like laughed at him and said, no, but really. And he said, that's the way that I learned it. So are there like definite rules in Yiddish grammar?
There are some kind of big rules like there are in English. I think they're kind of easily picked up. There are big rules. You know, there's certain word order, the verb usually comes as the second clause in a sentence, things like that. But not nearly as many as, say, German or Russian.
Okay. Now, and also then with vocabulary, there's the, we recently received a copy of a brand new Yiddish dictionary. I forget who it was that did it. It's two volumes, and it has a companion one volume English to Yiddish dictionary. It seems like there's a whole, even though some of the words are very long, but it seems like there's a whole lot less words in Yiddish than there is in English. Not so many synonyms, as you might say.
Well, it really depends on the subject. So there are areas of life in which Yiddish has many more words than English, and areas where it has very, very few. So if you want to talk about, I mean, and these things are, I'd say, intimately connected with the breadth of Jewish life, especially in Europe. So there are areas of life where you don't really need words in Yiddish because it's taken care of in another language. Like, there are very few Yiddish words for different species of plant.
Okay.
So there's very few botanical terminology because you have a tree, you have a bush. You have a bush that's poisonous, you have a bush you eat, and that's it. Knowing more than that isn't necessary to live life as a Jew.
Yeah, an apple
However,
in Yiddish is an apple.
There are four or five words for thinking. There's three words for arguing, for different types of arguing, and there's eight different words for potato.
Okay, I guess the different types. And like, unlike America, there were 50 words for drunk in English. How many words are there for drunk in Yiddish? I only know of one. And that's shikr. So, because Jews didn't get drunk, you know, so.
Yeah, Jews didn't get drunk.
Indeed.
So it really depends. However, there's a kind of translator's rule of thumb. You know, the vocabulary and verbosity are not necessarily the same. If you have one page in English, to translate it into Hebrew, it'll turn out to be a paragraph and a half. To translate it into Yiddish, it'll be four pages.
Right, but because it's a different language. I mean, because it's a long language. So, indeed.
Yeah, you tend to use more words in Yiddish.
Indeed. But, okay, we're going to have to wrap it up at this point. So, again, our guest today has been Nachum Eichenhorn, who is a Yiddish scholar, and will be teaching classes at Jewish Ferndale Tuesday nights, 7:30, and you can go to the website and find out when that's going to begin. We're hoping, and Nachum, how soon do you envision we should be starting? Today's like the 4th or 5th of November already, and when do you think we could be up and running? couple weeks?
I would say, next couple weeks.
Before Thanksgiving.
I should think so.
Okay. So if you have any questions about that, you can go to jewishferndale.com. You can drop me a line. And we'll be in touch. And there's a whole plethora of classes which are now ongoing and starting at Jewish Ferndale. Check the calendar. It's all listed right there. You have to scroll down to the bottom of the Jewish Ferndale page to get to the calendar. You'll see all kinds of wonderful things. Thank you for coming. This is. I've had lots of people talk about Yiddish over the last 20 years. This is probably the most enlightening. But I do have one question. This is my mother's pet peeve. How do you say sweater in Yiddish? Nothing.
Sweater.
How do you say sweater?
First of all, the answer that I think my Yiddish teacher would give is, first of all, sweaters are goyish. Second of all, there's different ways. I think people would say shredded in
right.
like a modern street Yiddish. You wouldn't say schwitzer.
No one would call it a schwitzer.
Yeah, if that's what you're asking.
No, because in Australia, where I was, the way that they say it, sweater, was jumper, which is how you say it in Australian. When you're in Australia, you get cold, you put on a jumper. And there's no J in Yiddish. You have to take three letters to make a J sound, a D, an S H, and a Z. You know, put them all together and you get J. So this was like one of my mother's, like, she spoke a wonderful Yiddish,
well,
but said there's no word in Yiddish for sweater. And it might be interesting
this is one of those things, to close it out, where there are several words in Yiddish for the same thing, and they usually come from a different language. So, which is why, in modern kind of Hasidic Yiddish, the word would be shredded, but there are older terms, like there's different words in Russian that would have been used in the Russian Empire. There are different things like that. So there's like svita and sermega and shinul and a lot of different things that meant different kinds of sweaters.
Okay, fascinating. So I'm fascinated by this, and I hope you are too, enough to sign up for the course. And thank you very much. Thank you for coming on. This has been very enlightening, very entertaining. And we love it. And people want to learn more, come to the class. Thank you so much,
Nahum.
Come to
the class. Thank you, Rabbi.
We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Herschel Finman here. You're listening to the Jewish Hour. At this point, it would probably be appropriate that I play a Yiddish song, but I'm not going to do that till the next break. So, but this is up next for your listening pleasure. This is Yaakov Shveki, Ani Mamim Benisim. I believe in miracles.
Mami, Benisim, ani yodeh.
assurance of quality and excellence in kosher? Look for the Michigan K on the label. What's it look like? The Lower Peninsula of Michigan with a K. It's the symbol of the Michigan Kosher Supervisors. Go to their website, mikosup.com. That's M-I for Michigan, K-O for kosher, and S-U-P for supervisors, mikosup.com, and find this month's featured products. You'll find Michigan K products wherever fine food is sold, especially at Natural Food Patch on West 9 Mile Road in Ferndale.
Hey, Schultzman here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. Up next, we had a request. This is from Dr. Sam Wiener from Huntington Woods, wants to hear the famous song. He's a Yiddish person, and I hope maybe he'll come by and check out Nachum Eichenhorn's Yiddish sessions at Jewish Ferndale beginning Tuesdays at 7:30. And if you have a request, something you'd like to hear, well, go to rabbifinman.com and go in the contact part and tell me what you'd like to hear. It could be in a specific song. It could be a specific or a general genre or just something that maybe you thought about something somewhere, and just send me it and we'll get it for you if we possibly can. So this is the immortal Mandy Potemkin singing the Rebbe Elimelech.
Is geworden sehr freilich, is geworden sehr freilich, Elimelech. Hat ausgetan die Tfilin und hat angetan die Brillen und geschickt nach die Fiedler die Zweier. Und die Fiedel, dicke Fiedler, haben Fiedel, dicke Fiedel, haben Fiedel, dicke Fiedel, haben sie. Und die Fiedel, dicke Fiedler, haben Fiedel, dicke Fiedel, haben Fiedel, dicke Fiedel, haben sie. Und als der Rebbe Elimelech is geworden noch mehr freilich, is geworden noch mehr freilich, Elimelech. Hat abgemacht auf Dolle, mit'n Schamis Reben auf Tolle, und geschickt nach der Peikler die Zweier. Und die Peikler, haben Peikler, dicke Peikler, haben Peikler, dicke Peikler, haben sie. Und die Peikler, haben Peikler, dicke Peikler, haben Peikler, dicke Peikler, haben sie. Und als der Rebbe Elimelech ist gewohnt, Gostakweilich ist gewohnt, Gostakweilich, Elimelech. Hat euch getan das Gittel und hat dann getan das Sittel und geschickt nach den Zimbler, die zwei. Ah, die Zimbel, dicke Zimbler, haben Zimbel, dicke Zimbel, haben Zimbel, dicke Zimbel, haben sie. Und die Zimbel, dicke Zimbler, haben Zimbel, dicke Zimbel, haben Zimbel, dicke Zimbel, haben sie. Ah, der Rebbe Elimelech ist gewohnt, schicker Feiler, ist gewohnt, schicker Feiler, Elimelech. Hat abgedaffen, Nila, mit der Hatze, dicke Zwille und geschickt nach der Klesmer, die zwei. Und als die Fiedel, dicke Peikler, haben Zimbel, dicke Fiedel, haben Peikler, dicke Zimbel, haben sie. Und die Zimbel, dicke Peikler, haben Peikler, dicke Fiedel, haben Zimbel, dicke Peikler, haben sie. Und der Rebbe Elimelech ist gewohnt, schicker Feiler, ist gewohnt, schicker Feiler, Elimelech. Hat abgedaffen, Nila, mit der Hatze, dicke Zwille und geschickt nach der Klesmer, die zwei.
Some things are better the way they used to be, like the crisp feel of a cool autumn day, the serenity of a baby sleeping, or the feeling of coming home after a long trip. Franklin Cider Mills makes cider the way cider is supposed to be. Its old-fashioned, clear, crisp taste reminds you of a cool autumn day. Located in the heart of historic Franklin Village at 14 Mile and Franklin Road, Franklin Cider Mill has been making cider the same way for over a century. Always fresh, with no additives or preservatives. You just can't buy Franklin Cider in any supermarket. Franklin Cider Mill is open from Labor Day weekend to after Thanksgiving from 7 a.m. to 6 p.m. Come visit Franklin Cider Mill. It's kind of like coming home.
Harry Schulzman here. We still got time for one more. And now for something completely different. This group is called Sephardi, which means they play Spanish music. The word Sephard is Hebrew for Spain. This song is called Ki Em Shor Shabbat, which is, it's sung in Ladino. Maybe it's sung in Hebrew. I'm not exactly sure. But it's a typical Friday night song, which is sung at the meal and talking about how great the Shabbos is. Let's listen in.
She
Why go to a hospital to get healthy? At Encompass Healthcare, you get the state-of-the-art wound care like in a hospital. The same medicines, the same everything without being in a hospital. Why put yourself at risk of getting a hospital-borne infection? Did you know that last year, 1 in 6 people died in America because of infections they got in hospitals? Encompass Healthcare is an outpatient facility. That means you get your wound care treatment and then go home. There are no wait times at Encompass Healthcare like in ERs. Healthcare is personal and works better, faster, and easier. Encompass Healthcare provides a state-of-the-art outpatient facility close to where you live. Call 248-624-9800. That's 624-9800. Auto accident, workman's comp, and most insurance is accepted. Encompass Healthcare's goal is to get you healthy with as little disturbance to your daily activities. Call 248-624-9800. Shai Shulton here. You are listening to the Jewish Hour. This week is the portion of Chaya Sarah, which talks about, the beginning part talks about Avraham acquiring Hebron, the city of the patriarchs, as it is called, the burial place of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Sarah, Rivka, Leah, and we have a tradition also of Adam and Eve buried there. And there's an interesting statement which is made that Hebron is called like the worst place in Israel as far as what it looks like, the topology and whatnot. It's actually pretty good, if you ask me. I have a picture hanging on my wall at home, painted by the famed Hasidic artist Baruch Nachshon, called The Hills of Hebron. And when I got to Hebron, I went, wow, that's the picture. And it's amazing. But Hebron is called the ugliest place in Israel. And yet it says that Hebron, the ugliest place in Israel, is still much nicer than the most beautiful place in Egypt. So, but that's just an aside point. The portion spends most of the time on the marriage of Isaac. Abraham's really concerned now. Listen, he's 40 years old. He still lives at home. It'd be good if he got, when's he going to get grandchildren over here? You know the line, yada, yada, yada. And the whole interaction between the servant of Abraham and the family of the bride, Rivka's family, Lavan and Bisuel. And then eventually, at the very end, it's like sort of like a tag on, and oh yeah, they got married. And then I suppose lived happily ever after, but that's the next week's portion. There's an interesting exchange that goes on. It's brought, you don't see it if you're actually reading it. It's between the lines and is brought down with Rashi. And it says there that they're having this whole handling thing. They're arguing back and forth, what, you know, how much are we going to give? What are we going to do? How's it going to happen? Yeah, back and forth. And there's an exchange there between Bisuel and Lavan and the servant. And then in the morning, it says Bisuel, her mother, Rivka's mother, and the servant. So the question is, wait a minute, what happened? Excuse me, Lavan and the mother and the servant. So the question comes up is, wait a minute, what happened to Bisuel? He's like the man. Why are they suddenly dealing with the brother and the mother? And it says that really what the Bisuel wanted to do was to poison the servant, keep all the stuff that he had brought as a dowry or as a down payment, as a payment for his daughter, and keep the daughter, and that way he'd have both. And so what did he do? Is he put poison in the drink of the servant, but this is like right out of like a really bad movie. Bisuel drank the wrong drink, and he drank the poison, and he died. So what are we going to learn from this story? Everything is a lesson. So what do we learn from this? It says things are going to happen, and the things that are going to happen are going to happen, regardless of what we may want to happen. So we could do some good planning. It's a Yiddish expression, man tracht und Gott lacht, which translates as man plans and God laughs. Because if God doesn't want it to happen, it's not going to happen. So therefore, what's our recourse at this? I'm not saying don't try to poison people, please. But we have plans. And very often, plans are not going to go the way that we planned them. But that's because plans go according to the way that God plans them. And we should be able to appreciate it and accept that what happened, even though it's not the way that I might encounter it, and I could do things a whole different way, better, I think God knows best. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be right back. You're listening to The Jewish Hour.
Hi, this is Specs Howard. The Specs Howard School of Media Arts is proud to have been a sponsor of The Jewish Hour and bring quality radio programming to the community. While much of the funding comes from its sponsors, listeners like you help keep The Jewish Hour on the air. Please send your tax-deductible donation to The Jewish Hour, 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. That's 1725 Pinecrest Drive, Ferndale, Michigan, 48220. Your help is greatly appreciated. Thank you very much.
Herschel Fidman here. You are listening to The Jewish Hour. Want to get in touch with me? Easiest way, go to rabbifinman.com, rabbifinman.com, And right on the homepage is the contact us. You don't have to go looking around any place. As I was sitting here, I was looking around. I had to contact somebody. And it took me, I think it took me about 3 minutes to find where it says contact. I had to go all the way down the bottom, and it said about us, and I clicked on the about us. And then at the bottom of the about us page, there was something that said contact. And then it was like, ugh. You know, so no, you want to contact me. I want to make it easier. That's what I'm here. I'm here for you. So right on the contact page of Rabbi Finman, right on the homepage of RabbiFinman.com, you'll be able to contact me. Whatever it is, any question, comment, query, criticism, we love it all. And I answer it all. And if you get it in today, I'll probably answer it today because this afternoon is when I spend most of my time answering letters that come in. Because people, when they want to write something, if they want to do something, it's like, if you do it right now, you're going to do it. If you wait till tomorrow, I forgot about it already. So then you'll also find archived editions of the show. We got about 2 years of show back there. You could do a marathon. Let me know how that goes for you. 100 hours of the Jewish Hour in consecutive. Wow. I'll give you a prize if you do. Just let me know how it goes. There's also archived editions of the E-Parsha, U-Parsha, Hasidic U-Story in classes presented by yours truly, Judaism in a hopefully entertaining and educational way. And there's also the donations page. It is now November. August, still here for us at the Jewish Hour, and we probably have until like the end of the month to get August in, because we really don't want to push it past 3 months. So we've been on air, we've been doing this, we do this every month. It's the same thing. We get 1 month paid, but we still have more months late, and sometimes we get 2 months in. It's never happened that we got 3 months in, but I can guarantee you this, that if before the end of November, we have November paid for, I'm not going to sit here and talk about how much we need money, because you're listening to the Jewish Hour. You like listening to the Jewish Hour. You've helped keep the Jewish Hour on air for 21 years now. It's time to pay to play, as we say. And it's good for you, too. I mean, it's considered a charity. It is tzedakah. It is tax deductible. We got the new tax code coming up. So if you want to get those tax deductions in for this year, you better do it this year. And like I say, what I just said before, you're going to wait for tomorrow. You're going to forget about it. So go right now to the computer. Go to RabbiFinman.com. Click on the donations page. Click on a number. Make it monthly if you'd like to. Doesn't have to be. If you want to do one big, that's fine. If you want to do a bunch of smalls, also good. If you want to do a bunch of bigs, that's also good. We take them. You want to take one small? Whatever it is, we need your help. We'd like to go 22 years, 25 years, 30 years. Till the show's 120, I guess, would be the way to look at it, but do it today. We have, for the show, this last week was the 230th anniversary of the passing of a chassid, a student of the Baal Shem Tov by the name of Wolf Kitzis. And I just found out, looking at this, that Wolf Kitzis is actually buried in the grave next to the Baal Shem Tov in Mezhebuzh, as he was the rabbi of the town of Mezhebuzh. The Baal Shem Tov was the Rebbe. And people would go to the Baal Shem Tov to have, like, problems solved. And people would go to the rabbi to have Jewish questions answered. So it's two different jobs. And about the piety of this Wolf Kitzis, the Baal Shem Tov said, "You and I are but a hand breadth away, but you'll never cross that a hair's breadth away, but you'll never cross that hair's breadth." Wolf Kitzis decided at the end of his life that he wanted to go to Israel and live out his years there. And the Baal Shem Tov told him, be very careful if anybody asks you a question when you're traveling. So he's traveling. They stopped off in some island someplace. The way to go from Mezhebuzh is you have to go through the Black Sea to Turkey and overland. So he stops off in a boat, stops off on an island. And somebody came up to him when he was walking around and said, "Hey, you're from Europe. How are things in Europe for the Jews in Europe?" And he said, Baruch Hashem, it's okay. Said, no problem. Said, Baruch Hashem. Then he realized that he wasn't careful with his answer. And he went back to Mezhebuzh and told the Baal Shem Tov what had happened. And he said, "I told you had to be careful how you answered questions. There was an argument in heaven. The patriarch Abraham was saying Jews are treated cruelly." And God said, "No, they're not." He said, "Well, who could we ask?" And they said, "Well, let's ask Wolf Kitzis." So the one who just asked you that question, how things were, was the patriarch Abraham. You should have said, life in Europe is terrible. And Mashiach would have come. That's going to do it. We hope you had a chance to entertain you a bit. We hope you have a great week. We hope to see you back again next week. Take care.